I had Nicholas Prophet in last week.
You did?
Yeah. Did you read his book?
I've just seen it.
Gardens of Stone.
Gardens of Stone.
It's quite a bit different from yours.
Does it cover Vietnam, or is it basically, was it about the soldiers at Arlington?
Yes, something? It's about the, what do they call it?
The Honor Guard?
Yeah, the Old Brigade, isn't that what they call it? The Old Guard. But it takes place during the Vietnam War era.
Uh-huh.
It's different from yours because Prophet is a journalist by trade, and he writes in a more direct way.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Whereas you have a much more mystical, philosophical approach than he does. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that... Well, first, before we go into the book, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background and give me a little idea of what your story is?
I was born in Warren, Pennsylvania, and basically grew up in Cleveland. Went all through elementary school and high school, and then from Cleveland went to Ohio State. And it was while I was in college that got reclassified by the draft and was taken in May of 69. And from there, the Army sent me to intelligence school at Fort Holabird, which is in Baltimore, Maryland. And I think that lasted about 3-4 months. And then from there, it was they sent us direct, probably the entire class, just direct to Vietnam. First week in December 1969. I was there from that week to the end of November 1970.
What were your feelings about being drafted?
Well, they were extremely ambivalent. At the time, I was I had kind of lost interest in what I was doing in school, and that's why I was reclassified. I wasn't going to classes that much anymore, and I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. You know, I wanted to get away from home. I think it's the way the military is often able to get, young men who are just unsure at the moment of what they want to do. And so I went, but not that willingly. It was extremely ambivalent. I think that once I was in, it became more difficult. There were moments where it was a big wrestling with even, going over there. You knew you were going to go, probably, since 90% of all of these intelligence classes were sent to Vietnam. And I have to admit that I did ponder it long and hard. They had us in Washington, see, before we were all shipped out, and they had us for a week extra training in Washington. And that was the exact week. That was November 69, that was the largest demonstration, I think, in the history of the United States. I don't know if you remember that. There were 300 and some thousand people packed into Washington. They brought up the 82nd Airborne from Fort Bragg. Nixon was in the White House, and by coincidence, I think the White House, not the White House, the Washington bus company was on strike. So they had all these buses they could park bumper to bumper around the White House. I mean, it was an incredible time. Absolutely incredible. The feeling in the air was different from anything I've experienced before since. And it was right at that moment you said, do I really want to go? And I think had someone from one of those draft resistance groups that were tunneling people into Canada and stuff gotten a hold of me right then, I think I would have been liable to their persuasion. But I think what it came down to was I simply didn't want to risk the fact of not being able to be back in the country. Now, then you didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, it was quite likely that if you left the Army, refused to go over there, went to Sweden, Canada, it was quite likely you were never going to come back to this country again, unless you wanted to risk prosecution and jail. And I think finally that's what my own turmoil about it, I think that's what it finally all revolved on. I would rather go through this than to be shut out of the United States for the rest of my life.
In one of the early chapters in Meditations in Green, the commanding officer is telling the new recruits, giving the recruits a lecture about Vietnam and why they were there and why they shouldn't question. Does the military indeed take a philosophical approach in indoctrinating troops to the assignment that these troops are going to have to carry out?
What I went through, there was a certain, but it was very minimal. It was an extremely lackadaisical. It was kind of offhand propaganda. There's simply, I think, a directive just comes down that this group at a certain period in its training is required to all be marched over to a theater, sat down in the seats, and we were shown a State Department film, which obviously is U.S. propaganda, and I remember it distinctly. It's the film that I kind of make reference to. Those images come out of this film. It was called Why Vietnam, and it basically revolved around a speech that Lyndon Johnson gave, I can't remember the circumstances, in which he was attempting to explain to some group of people why Vietnam. And they wove his speech in and out of these harrowing scenes of the communists in Vietnam, and the thing ran about 20 minutes, I guess. And that was like the history of the war. We were provided by the State Department. And we had that, and then we had one. See, that was later. That was once I was in intelligence school. That was right before shipping out. I think it's one of the last things they do was show you this film. In basic training, we had one lecture by a captain. And it was very similar to what I describe in the book. It's just basically, this is the way it is, and he gets all done. These are the facts. Are there any questions? And of course, no one dares to move or raise their hand. And that was the insight into the history of this experience that we were given.
How long were you in Vietnam?
A year.
You were in intelligence there. Did you see combat yourself?
Not really. I was a intelligence specialist, but I was in an opportunity. It was a very good opportunity to experience the war as a whole, like from the bottom to the top, because kind of intelligence is right in the middle. And while most of my job was an office job, I was everything to had gone out on a few patrols and then in the planes a lot. And so it was from the ground to the air. And I also had a lot of experience of coming in contact with very high ranking officers. So it really gave me an opportunity to see a kind of kaleidoscope of the war that maybe other people didn't.
The drug culture seemed to permeate the American military in Vietnam. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it certainly surprised me when I got over there. Because at the time that I arrived, if I remember correctly, there was as yet no news about this in the United States. In fact, it was the very day I arrived, arrived back in the United States, checked into a hotel in Chicago to wait a connecting flight, turned on the TV, because I hadn't seen television in here, and it was all very strange. And Walter Cronkite was on, and one of the things they were showing was one of the first film of people at a fire base, blowing marijuana through shotgun barrels, and I just had to laugh. This is the kind of thing that I saw, and finally it was being reported back in the country. And so it really surprised me. It seemed to me what I saw was everyone from the lowest ranking private to officers was on something. You would have a definite break off, say once you got into career NCOs and career officers, then 90% of them were drinking constantly. And then the enlisted people were all smoking constantly. And so it was an incredible spectacle, really. And I think one thing that needs to be made clear about this, though, is that I was there in 69-70. People who were in Vietnam, 64-65, all the way up, I think, to 68, which is probably the watershed year for the war and the country, the Tet Offensive, Johnson resigning the presidency, the army losing hope. People in the earlier part did not experience drugs. I think it was once the army knew that this is over, and now it's only, even though we're still here, there's still over 400,000 of us here, it is over as far as the United States is concerned, and what's going on at home is trying to find a politically feasible way to get out. And once that happens, once everyone becomes aware of it, you have an immediate disintegration of morale, if it hadn't disintegrated some before that. And I think that's when the dope was really able to take hold. It was just extraordinary, really.
You have one horrible scene of helicopter wreckage and the bodies dangling by chains, horribly dismembered. Was that the kind of war Vietnam was?
Well, that's kind of war every war is. I don't know if I can say for sure that there's anything, as far as the horror of it, that is specific just to Vietnam and didn't occur at Troy. I think those kinds of things happened on both sides. On our side, it would occasionally happen because of the frustration of walking out into the bush, being shot at by people you never see, and the anger, especially among combat troops, could get quite high. And then what would happen is that once they got into a village or something, they didn't always exercise all the restraint that they might have under other circumstances. And I think as far as the North Vietnamese were concerned, they were equally angry, and they were probably the most intense army over there. They certainly had more will than even the South Vietnamese or we did, and they did equally brutal things simply to keep the population under control and to kind of show the people of the South that if you collaborate with the Americans, this is what will happen.
A term developed from Vietnam known as fragging, which apparently indicated a great amount of frustration among the enlisted men toward their officers. Was this really a problem?
By the time I got there, it was becoming a major problem. And I suspect that there were many more people killed in this manner than we're ever going to know. I think those deaths probably listed in statistics as combat or accidental in many cases. But what was happening was people rolling grenades under hooches while officers were sleeping, officers and senior NCOs. The thing would go off and just tear the hell out of the wooden structures. At the actual unit I was in, it never went quite that far, but we actually had people placing hand grenades inside officers' quarters. A scene that I've described in the book with the CO there. What happened is the person would come back, open the door, and then you would just see this thing sitting there. And it's just like, this is the message, you know, quit it, get off our backs. The worst thing that people in my unit did was they actually set off a tear gas grenade, or a couple of them, outside the air conditioner in the officers' in the Oak Club. They were all inside having a farewell party, I think, for the executive officer, and people just set off some tear gas grenades and sent them, you know, running into the night with tearing eyes. So it was pretty nasty.
Looking back at it now with a perspective of 10 or 12 years, what do you think about our experience in Vietnam?
I think it's an extremely complex event. And it's obvious that only today are we even beginning to kind of open up this can of worms and look into it. I think up till now people talk about healing the wounds, this kind of thing, and that we've learned some lessons. Well, as far as I can see, I don't think we've learned anything. And I think it's very important that we start looking into this and start examining it much more thoroughly than it's been done. I think if there's one lesson that Vietnam teaches, it's that you cannot insert American power into the rest of the world without really being aware of the reality of each of these individual situations. I think when you read the history of Vietnam, it's obvious that to so many people in the various administrations that dealt with it, this conflict was merely an abstract game in a geopolitical struggle between us and, quote, communism, unquote, without any concern or interest in the history of the Vietnam people, of the country, of a struggle that had been going on for them for 2,000 to 3,000 years. And I think we just went in there with a certain amount of arrogance. I think, well, now we can do what we want. And I don't see any evidence that we've learned any restraint.
Is Grenada a case in point?
Well, in some ways, I think what's going on today, I think we're still trying to win the Vietnam War. I think this is something that is going on in many people's minds, whether they're actually thinking that consciously or not. This is what I mean about really taking the war in. We lost. People don't talk about that. We lost. We never did that before. It obviously bothers a lot of politicians, and it bothers a lot of military people, because the assumption is that now we're afraid to use our power. They're kind of equating caution and restraint with being afraid, something I don't necessarily agree with. And I think I think we don't know enough about Grenada. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Here we just go in. I don't know anything about Grenada. I don't know anyone else who does either. And no news people were allowed there. So it's a very suspicious endeavor as far as I'm concerned. It just seems here's one we can win. In fact, I've read news accounts of various conservative groups and organizations who are expressing ecstatic joy and actually saying things like, at last, one we can win. Now, people wouldn't be talking that way if it hadn't been for Vietnam.
Stephen Wright, isn't it interesting that so much literature is just now coming out of our experience in Vietnam?
Yeah, I think part of this is the difficulty of absorbing it, and it's probably the people who went through it, their difficulty in getting it down. I know this was a major problem for me. In World War II, if you'd been in World War II, the form of your book is basically given to you by the form of the experience of that war itself. It had a clear beginning, a middle, and an end, a definite end. The issues, the morality of it was much clearer. You can string a book between those points a lot easier than you can with Vietnam, which basically, as I experienced, was a kind of amorphous blob that resisted being put into literary form. And I struggled with it for a long, long time until finally this plant imagery started coming to me. Once I seized on that, I saw how the entire book and all the things that I wanted to say about the war could kind of be hung on this hook. And then once that happened, I was able to proceed at a much quicker pace than I had earlier. But it certainly is a struggle to get it down, because I realized earlier that to really do this book well, to do it the way I wanted to do it, I would have to process the entire war through my head, not a very joyful prospect. And so it was just a matter of gearing yourself up. And
did your experience in the Iowa Writers' Workshop help you in this endeavor?
Yeah, they got me. It was the fact of like just being there and being forced to write, because you have to produce a certain number of pages to get an MFA. And you're also encouraged. One of my instructors was John Irving, who was extremely supportive, who read this book in its early drafts with a high degree of enthusiasm. And was an extremely good editor for me, too. His comments, his opinions about it were very useful. And that kind of commenting while you're going along certainly helps you to start pulling it out.
Are you still in the workshop?
No. I was just a two-year program. I finished that and got an MFA.
Now what are you doing?
Now I'm unemployed.
Well, probably not for long, with the favorable reviews that I've seen for Meditations in Green, and I'm sure this is only the start of a very fine literary career for you, and it's not going to be your last, is it?
Oh, no. I don't have any plans for this being the last. I hope this is just the beginning.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Okay, it's great being here.